Okay. Good evening. So the preceding weeks have posed challenges. I don't mean these specific past few weeks, but on the calendar, the season that is often marked in America during this time poses a big challenge for Jews, for anybody who wants to be part of society, especially for kids who grew up in a surrounding culture that they want to be part of. And yet, the culture surrounding the holidays, Christmas, definitely defines us as being different, as being outsiders, that we don't put up lights, we don't have the same music, there's no Santa Claus. You know, the images that are ubiquitous can make us feel like outsiders. When I wanted to quote, I was having some difficulty pulling this up. There's an excellent article that our friend Rabbi Dr. Stuart Halpern published recently, which was called "Saying No to the Very Special Christmas TV Episodes." And he was talking about how he's very culturally open. His kids watch TV, but the one line that he has is that his kids cannot watch any special episodes of any TV show that have to do with Christmas. And why is that? Because what it means to have diversity is that we're different, that if we were just all part of the same culture, so there wouldn't be anything unique about us, there wouldn't be unique about anything, but we need those boundaries that separate us, that define us as unique, that define us as being special as Jews, as much as we want to seamlessly fit into society. And this is very much in the spirit of a particular midrash that it says, Rav Huna Amar B'Shem Bar Kapara. It's a very famous midrash. B'Shvil Arba Dvarim Nigalu Yisrael Mimitzrayim. Shelo Shinu Eshmam V'Lashonam V'Lo Amru L'Lashon Hara V'Lo Nimtza B'Neham Ela Echa Mehen Paritz Be'erva. So this is a midrash relevant right now as we get into Parsha Shmos. It doesn't actually go in any particular pasuk in Parshat Shmot, but it's a midrash that gets brought up at this time because this is the parsha where, on the one hand, at the very beginning, it seems like Bnei Israel are part of Mitzrayim. They're coming off the heels of Yosef's very successful leadership in Egypt, and yet they're starting to be seen as outsiders. As they stay longer, and they're perceived as a threat, and yet, as the story begins of their slavery, and even the beginning of their redemption, as we see towards the end of the parsha, why did they merit redemption? They didn't change their names, they didn't change their language, they didn't say Lashon Hara, and they weren't involved in Gilui Arayos, they weren't involved in any sort of illicit relationships. So the last two are particular mitzvahs, or their particular prohibitions, we should say, they're in the Torah. And why specifically those two could be discussed, but there's definitely a strong connection to mitzvahs in the Torah. When it comes to language, so Avram is defined as an Ivri. So we're defined as being Hebrews, Hebrew language, and when the Torah says Kipi Hamidaber Aleichem, the mouth that speaks to you, that's referring to Lashon HaKodesh. Bnei Israel kept Lashon HaKodesh even in their time in Eretz Mitzrayim. Now the issue of not changing their names is something I discussed last year, but what I wanted to discuss particularly tonight is the fact that they didn't change their language. And the other thing we'll discuss is dress. People often assume that the Medrash says that they also didn't change their dress. It's something that's brought by other sources, but this particular Medrash actually doesn't include dress, but nonetheless, we are going to discuss it. So, what this Medrash highlights is that the fact that we didn't change names and we didn't change our language signifies the fact that that it's specifically being different and diverse that got us out of there. If we had blended in, there wouldn't have been any way to get out of there. We would have just sort of assimilated. Slavery was physically hard. We needed our redemption from that. But on the other hand, we could have just sort of disappeared into oblivion. We could have just been, another group of people and why not? But what really united us as being an entity, it's the fact that we preserved a particular identity. And then the question is, what would redemption have been worth anyway if we weren't anything? Great, we would have gotten out of Egypt, but then what? What happens from there? Well, what would have been changed? So a question that perhaps comes out of this, if part of the reason why we were redeemed is because we didn't change our language, because we kept speaking Hebrew. So does this suggest that speaking Hebrew is a mitzvah, or is it just an identity marker? So there's a Seferi and also a Tosefta to this extent, Tanaitic sources that say v'limadtem otam b'neichem, that should teach Torah to your children. As soon as a child begins to speak, his father should speak to him in Lashon HaKodesh, in Hebrew, u'melamdo Torah, and also to speak Torah with him. Im ein medaber imo b'lashon kodesh ve'eno melamdo Torah, ro'i lo ki'ilu kovro. It's as if he buried him. So we see from here that that it's somewhat incumbent upon a father to teach his children, or parents. We could generalize it. It doesn't have to be the father necessarily, but it's incumbent upon the parents to teach their children to speak Hebrew, to be involved in Talmud Torah. It's something that's high stakes. It doesn't necessarily give a source as in a pasuk. It's not necessarily a mitzvah d'oraisa. From here, we don't necessarily see that. Something very important. Likewise, there's something in the Talmud Yerushalmi that says that when a child knows how to, if they know how to shake something, know how to wave something, chayav belula, they become obligated to learn how to shake a lula. Yodei lis atef, if they know how to put on clothes, once they know how to put on clothes on their own, chayav tzitzis, they should wear tzitzis. And yodei ledaber, if they know how to speak, aviv melamdo lashon Torah, his father should teach him the language of Torah. So the idea of teaching, of learning Hebrew, of being taught Hebrew at a young age is something that's found in the Midrashim, something that's found to be very significant. And what's noteworthy here is its relation to the mitzvah of learning Torah, that ostensibly learning Hebrew helps us learn Torah. And we'll get to the implications of that and what we see in the contemporary period a little bit later, but this is what we have so far from early sources. Now, the Rambam, when he enumerates the mitzvahs, and even just in the Mishnah Torah in general, so he makes no mention of there being any mitzvah to learn Hebrew. So the fact that it's Lashon HaKodesh, something that's so foundational, so it's actually very interesting on some level that it's not identified as being any sort of obligation. We have these sources, but it doesn't seem like that there's any Torah basis for it. Mishnah Torah doesn't include it. Doesn't seem to be a clear-cut halacha. But there's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos that says, "Heve zahir b'mitzvah kala kevachamura," that we should be cautious in a light mitzvah like a heavy mitzvah. The Rambam in his commentary on the Mishnah says, so what's a mitzvah kala? Kigom simchas harega, midas lashon kodesh, learning Hebrew, learning the holy tongue, the holy language. What's an example of mitzvah chamura? Smila tzitzis and korban pesach. What's significant about those heavyweight mitzvahs is that bris milah is nisikaris. It's a severe punishment if one doesn't do it. Same thing with korban pesach. If you don't do it, it's kares. Yeah, it's a very, very important mitzvah. And tzitzis is compared to, wearing tzitzis is compared to doing all the mitzvahs. So those are all very significant mitzvahs. So when we talk about a light mitzvah, and simchas regel is in fact found in the Torah, being happy, being joyful on holidays is found in the Torah. So You know, maybe that's a light mitzvah because it's easy to do. Lamidas Lashon HaKodesh, though, doesn't seem to appear anywhere in the Torah, yet the Rambam seems to count it as being somewhat of a mitzvah, somewhat of an obligation. But maybe, you know, maybe the implications of not preserving Lashon HaKodesh are not as severe as, let's say, not doing Korban Pesach or not doing Bris Milah, but still, nonetheless, something of a mitzvah. Rabbi Yaakov Emden was asked an interesting question. Generally speaking, we're not supposed to learn Torah in a restroom, any sort of facility of that sort. And Rabbi Yaakov Emden was asked if that applies to learning Mishkalei Hashmos V'Hapalim. In other words, Hebrew grammar. Can one learn Hebrew grammar in the bathroom? So on the one hand, first of all, you can speak Hebrew in a bathroom if you're just talking about mundane things. And grammar is grammar. It says that that Lashon Atzma Leika Mishum Kedusha. There's no intrinsic holiness to the language itself. Elabaser Inga Nazlinan. It depends on what the subject matter is. However, he says, perhaps it is prohibited because you can't learn Lashon HaKodesh without being involved in Ksuvim, without being involved in scripture, without learning the Tanakh, where Hebrew originates, at least for us. You have to be involved in learning Tanakh, or you're going to think of parts of Tanakh. We associate Hebrew first and foremost with Tanakh, as opposed to, let's say, Gemara, which is in Aramaic. But Tanakh as a foundational text is written in Hebrew, and that's the associations we have. And it's instrumental to learning on Tanakh, and Tanakh might be instructive for Hebrew grammar. So perhaps that would be problematic. And since you can't think about Tanakh in the bathroom, maybe there is a problem. I might parenthetically say that perhaps this is different in modern times, because once upon a time it really was that the only thing you use Hebrew for really was for davening, for learning Torah. Nowadays, the Hebrew is its own language. You can take totally secular Hebrew grammar courses in universities, in Israeli universities, even in American universities. Maybe now it's different. But back then, it actually makes a lot of sense. Now, if learning Hebrew was its own mitzvah, then in theory, it really should be a separate prohibition, because you're not allowed to do a mitzvah in a bathroom, except for perhaps going in the bathroom itself constitutes somewhat of a mitzvah. But otherwise, perhaps if learning Hebrew and learning the mechanics of Hebrew language was a separate mitzvah, it would be forbidden on its own, not because of its relationship with Tanakh. But perhaps we can note that while some may think that grammar is insignificant, who needs to know it? It's seen as being sort of an academic pursuit, but not instrumental in learning Torah itself. So Rabbi Yaakov Emden, the Yavetz, thinks that learning Hebrew is in fact a holy endeavor, and there seems to be some sort of mitzvah involved in it. So it's possible from all these sources, if we put this all together, that Hebrew at the very least is a hechsher mitzvah that enables us to learn Torah. It's involved in learning Torah, but maybe it's not a separate mitzvah. Rabbi Yamin Tabori, in his Sefer HaMitzvah B'Parasha, the weekly mitzvah, notes the writing of Rabbi Baruch Epstein, who is the author of the Torah Tamima, lived just over a century ago, that in theory, Hebrew should be a mitzvah. Learning Hebrew should be a mitzvah, but really only operates in Eretz Yisrael because it's difficult to learn Hebrew. So it's one of those things that it's not a mitzvah that would apply in all times and places. This is a little bit of a chidush, but this is brought that perhaps the reason why it hasn't been thought of as a mitzvah is because for the most part, in Galut, it didn't make sense to force that upon people. It was enough to be educated in one language. Two languages perhaps was a little bit too difficult, and maybe while it would be wise, to whatever extent it's necessary to educate somebody, so you have to teach them certain aspects of the holy language. But but not a mitzvah in and of itself today. So if learning Hebrew is important because it's part of Talmud Torah, and indeed it remains difficult to learn Hebrew today, so is it a mitzvah? If one were to go to Eretz Yisrael with the existence of Eretz Yisrael, is it a mitzvah? So that's a question that perhaps needs to be reckoned with. But one place that it certainly can be relevant for us is in terms of Talmud Torah. Is there an idea that we should all be putting in with whatever else we're involved in terms of our growth in Judaism? Is learning Hebrew a central part of it? So Rav Tabori, who I just mentioned before, is of the opinion, of course, he's writing in Eretz Yisrael. He was born in America, I believe, and made Aliyah. He taught in Yeshivat Har Etzion, where I attended, although he was not active in the time that I was there. So he says that in our world today, when so much of Torah literature is available in translation, so one might wonder how important it is to study Lashon HaKodesh. Maybe nowadays, you know, it's difficult on the one hand to learn Hebrew, and on the other hand, there's so much that's being put out in English, in Artscroll, Feldheim, Koren, so much is available in translation. In theory, one can learn Torah today without knowing Hebrew, so it isn't necessary. So he says, in truth, besides the fact that much of Torah has not been translated, it is obviously better to study Torah in the original. The nuances and style of language are lost in translation. And the Havdil, if one reads Shakespeare in translation, does he get the full meaning and depth of that literature? So maybe, yes, there is an element that we can learn Torah in English. Right now, we are learning Torah in English, but if you want to learn texts, in theory, you could do it in English, but you're losing something from it. On the other hand, Rabbi Levi Greenberg writes on Chabad.org, and certainly this is, I think, indicative of a Chabad Shita, and not coming from any place other than wanting to bring Torah to as many Jews as possible. So he says, understanding the language of our tradition has always been a challenge, but never a barrier to Torah study. Obviously, to render halachic ruling or to develop an authoritative interpretation in Torah, one must be sufficiently fluent in the original. However, there is plenty of Torah to be learned in a plethora of languages, and I encourage you to embark on the journey of Torah discovery and allow Hebrew to come with time. So I think his position is certainly indicative of what's common today, that perhaps kids who are able to go to day school and able to develop those language skills, certainly it's great to be able to learn Hebrew and to be engaged in Torah in that fashion. Now, on the other hand, we're certainly not going to tell somebody that that Hebrew is a prerequisite to learning any Torah. Pick up whatever you're able to pick up in English, and maybe some Hebrew will come along with it. That's to some extent why I do include, I read sources in Hebrew often, just because I think, you know, I think there's something communicating that Torah, I think, reaches its full potential when the original language comes out. And yet, I recognize that that in any given audience, no matter where you're speaking, if you're a shul rabbi, there are going to be people who obviously benefit from their being in English. But I hope that in sharing some of the Hebrew, that by osmosis, it communicates some of the style that certain things maybe get picked up over time. So I think I think it's a wonderful thing to do. So far we've spoken about the importance of Hebrew in Talmud Torah, and that's not insignificant, because if Torah is the foundation of who we are, of how we live our lives, and learning Torah gives us that ability to be engaged in mitzvot and to be able to come closer to God. So learning Hebrew is certainly significant. It can be a very big enhancement to Jewish identity. But there's another aspect that I think is worth discussing here, not necessarily about Talmud Torah, but about prayer. The Mishnah in Sota says that the following things can be said in any language. Parshat HaSota, Vidui Meiser, when you bring your tithes and you do the confession as brought in Parshat Ki Tavo. Kriyat Shema and Tefillah, saying Shema and davening, Birkat HaMazon, benching, All those things can be done in English. Shvuot ha'edu, shvuot ha'pikadon, certain types of oaths. And then certain things have to be done in Hebrew. The mikra bikurim, the declaring the first fruits that are brought. Also, it was brought in Parshat Ki Tavo, and the chalitza ceremony, reading of the blessings and curses, birkat kohanim, the duchening has to be done in Hebrew. There are a number of things here listed that have to be done in Hebrew, but significantly, davening, both Shema and Shmona Esrei, the Amidah, can be done in any language according to the Mishnah. Now, why is this? So the Gemara comments, tefillah rachmehi. When we're davening, we're asking Hashem for compassion, for mercy. So kol heichi debay mitzali. So what, you're going to bar somebody from communicating with God for asking for this existential need for compassion because they don't know the language? So let them say it in any language. That's extremely important. And in fact, the Shulchan Aruch says that, codifies this, that you can daven in any language. It does make a distinction between the tzibor and the individual. If you were to ask me intuitively, would it be better for an individual or for a community to daven in Hebrew, I would say maybe, you know, the community davens from one seder, we daven in a unified way in Hebrew. Maybe individual communicates in any language. But actually, the Shulchan Aruch says that, and I think this comes from the Gemara as well, that the individual should daven in Hebrew, because when you're davening as an individual, so you don't have the direct access to God, but it's malachim, it's angels who bring the prayers up, and they don't necessarily know every language, so it has to be done in Hebrew. Whereas when you're in a community, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu is present in Shul at that time, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, of course, can understand any language, so you can dive in any language. But be that as it may, the idea of diving in any language is even codified in Shulchan Aruch. Yet this becomes a very big controversy in history that I don't think is insignificant for our topic tonight of preserving identity in exile in a foreign culture, because when Reform Judaism came to be, so one of its initial leaders, Rabbi Abraham Geiger, felt that they should do away with using Hebrew in prayer. So in this college textbook that I have, The Jews of History, so they write, there was a whole conference about the question of language in Jewish liturgy. And you know, they said, on the one hand, increasing use of German at home left fewer and fewer Jews with the command of Hebrew. So as people were becoming more acculturated, more assimilated, of course, they were very comfortable in German, and maybe knew, there were fewer and fewer people who knew Hebrew, certainly who knew Hebrew fluently. On the other hand, the continued use of what was once a Jew's national language might compromise the conferee's claims to German patriotism. So that in itself speaks a lot. That, to whatever extent that Hebrew is associated with the national language, that it's associated with Jewish identity, which I'm going to argue is actually very important. And that's specifically why the German Reformed Jews wanted to get rid of it, because they wanted to prove that they were patriots, that they were fully German. And yeah, they might have a particular religion, but they had every plan to remain in Germany, to be part of German society, and they wanted no accusations of dual loyalty. So there was a strong push to get rid of Hebrew from the liturgy. And Abraham Geiger said, supposedly, that Hebrew is his mother tongue, but a German prayer strikes a deeper chord than a Hebrew prayer, which is astounding to me. First of all, when I look at English translations of the Siddur, sometimes I feel like it's so, you know, there, I feel like there's like this distance, there's this barrier that it doesn't feel as, you know, authentic to me, that there's something lost there. I feel like the Hebrew really is where, is really where the authenticity lies. And yet here he is saying a German prayer strikes a deeper chord than a Hebrew prayer. So Rabbi Geiger supported getting rid of Hebrew liturgy. And he said, anyone who imagines Judaism to be a walking on the crutches of a language deeply offends it. So that's what he said. This resulted, partially resulted in the split with Zacharias Frankel. Zacharias Frankel was the founder of what was called positive historical Judaism, which was the antecedent, German antecedent of conservative Judaism, which speaks a lot of what conservative Judaism really was, both in Germany and the United States, was actually more of a split from Reform Judaism than it was a split from Orthodoxy. So while Frankl was in favor of certain kinds of reforms, he felt Hebrew was essential. It's a language of our scripture, which is a constant reminder of our covenant with God. And he was afraid that if you get rid of Hebrew from davening, only rabbis are going to know Hebrew. People are going to come farther away from Judaism, from knowledge. And that's a debate at the time. In some ways, it has implications until today. There's far more Hebrew in conservative prayer services than Reformed prayer services. But that's what you get. And when you look at some of the later postgame, okay, so already by the time you get to the Mishneh Berurah, the Aruch HaShulchan, just over 100 years ago, so they were certainly aware of and grappling with the effects of Reformed Judaism. So the Be'er Halacha writes, when it comes to davening any language, so he says that specific, when we're talking about davening in the vernacular, that's specifically for people who are Yerusha Maim. Maybe they think they can, you know, communicate with God in a certain way. They can dive with more kavana, but otherwise, people should daven in Hebrew. And he gives a number of reasons that the davening Hebrew comes with segulos. That's a language that Hashem communicated with prophets in, and the tefillos have deep secrets embedded with them in the language. And if you change the language, so you've lost some of those particular sodos that are embedded in it. And the Aruch HaShulchan also adds that the world was created in Hebrew by Yomer Elokim Vayehi Or. So Lashon Kodesh is very essential, and you don't want to separate that from Hebrew. In addition, the Aruch HaShulchan writes a scathing attack on those who change the language. He says that those who look at the Gemara carefully know that when it's talking about davening in a different language, it's not talking about getting rid of fixed prayer that was enacted by the Anshe Knesset HaGedola. It would be so brazen to change that. Lofty things embedded in the way that Anshe Knesset HaGedola formulated prayer. He says, Ha'osakein eino ela maise rasha kessel. That this is brazen, it's wicked, it's foolish. And the only time that you are really supposed to daven in different languages is to say certain personal supplications, certain tachnuni, maybe slichos could be said in English, but the prayers that are fixed in a particular way, the Aruch HaShulchan is very clear that they should not be done in any language. And here he is very clearly talking about the Reform and the way he attacks us. And he walks his walk. I was recently learning the Aruch HaShulchan's halachas of Tehillah. And when he goes through each bracha, he talks about how many letters are in each bracha, and different sources for them, and the meaning behind the way they were formulated. So for him, it's very important that you don't veer from the formulation that is given. So that's very important. So before we go on to discussing importance of dress, what I would suggest is that on one hand, it's true, Hebrew is difficult to learn, and we are in Galus. We speak English, and I think it's good for us to speak the language that society is in. I believe it's important to a large extent to be able to navigate, participate in the world that we are a part of. So I have no issue with speaking the vernacular, obviously. That is obviously not up for debate. But even as it is, Hebrew is difficult for learn. I remember that when I was much younger, my grandmother, my father's mother, was taking Hebrew classes. She did not learn a lot of Hebrew, but she wanted to be more educated. She was a lifelong learner. She was learning Hebrew, but she was finding it very difficult, and I, as this precocious 8-year-old who was in a day school, was, you know, I was so confused. Why is this difficult? It was so natural to me, and then I came to appreciate how learning languages later in life is much more difficult. And I think there's something to be said for the fact that I think it's a wonderful thing that in as much as we were discussing the importance of Hebrew for Talmud Torah, it's important that Torah is accessible in the languages of that people speak. And hopefully there are certain aspects of the Torah's language that can be communicated that anybody who wants to grow in their Judaism can pick up certain parts of Lashon HaKodesh. But no doubt that is a difficulty, but it's also good, I think, for the sake of our identity we've seen the effects. Those who chose to completely abandon Hebrew decided to daven in German, decided to daven exclusively in English. So that really did lead to a widespread decrease in a knowledge of Hebrew. So I definitely think that there's something crucial of making Hebrew part of it. And hopefully that as a community, so we work to bring ourselves to greater knowledge. And the truth is, I think that was a very redeeming part of my Jewish education. I did not go to yeshiva day schools. My Gemara education was quite weak in middle school and high school. And yeah, what I found was very interesting was that we learned a lot of Hebrew, because going to a Jewish day school meant that part of having a Jewish identity meant learning Hebrew, because it fosters a connection with the state of Israel. And my Hebrew was actually quite strong, whereas a lot of yeshiva graduates have quite weak Hebrew. And I always found that to be kind of strange, because the more Hebrew you know, the much easier it is to access text and to be able to read, to be able to converse in the Torah way of life. So I always found it perplexing that, and I think it's problematic that we don't do a better job of educating Hebrew in day schools. And I think it's very important to having access to Judaism and to Jewish culture. So I think that's one thing that I really gained from my Jewish education, and something that enhanced my Jewish identity is Hebrew. And on that note, I think it's something special that, you know, even as people might define certain parts of Israeli society as being not religious, not secular, whatever. So first of all, there might be a mitzvah involved in learning Hebrew, but just think about how defining that is for Israelis. That one thing that defines Israeli culture is its language. And whatever it's literature, poetry, whatever, it's expressed in Hebrew, because that's the language of Jews. So I think there's something beautiful in the fact, you know, Eliezer ben Yehuda definitely got that right, that reviving Lashon HaKodesh is something that really did a lot to enhance Jewish identity, even for those who maybe weren't so attached to religion. But there's something very Jewish about it, something redeeming. And perhaps it will be seen can constitute a mitzvah. What I want to pick up on from here is that there's this idea that B'nai Yisrael didn't change their dress in Egypt. And the truth is, there's not really a medrash about it. Rav Tabori notes that there's a ritva in his Haggadah that notes that, in fact, B'nai Yisrael were noticeable for their dress in Egypt. Kolbo says that in his Haggadah, a dress prevented assimilation. And Rav Tabori notes that actually, on the other hand, it's very likely that Moshe did not dress Jewishly. He grew up in Paro's palace. And when he flees, after he strikes the Egyptian who was oppressing a Jew, as we see towards the beginning of the Parsha, and Moshe runs away, and then he's helping Yitro's daughters. And the daughters say to Yitro, "Ish bitzu hitzilanu miyad haro'im." An Egyptian man saved us from the shepherds. So how did they know he was Egyptian? He must have been dressed in a particular way. So it seems like Moshe actually did not dress in a particularly Jewish way. But yet there are definitely sources that point, even if not the original Midrash, there are sources that point to the fact that that the Jews dressed in a particular way. Now, is this something that's custom requirement? Was it merely identity preserver? Is there mitzvah? Is there prohibition involved? So the Rambam writes that we're not supposed to go after chukos ovdei kochavim. We're not supposed to go on their path. We're not supposed to imitate them. And he specifically singles out dress, lo ben malbush, lo beseir, not the way we do our hair. And this is based on the verses, lo telchu b'chukot agoyim, do not go after the statutes of the nations, do not walk according to their statutes. So there's a number of psukim that indicate this. says rather a Jew should be separate, and he should be identifiable by his dress and his actions and his beliefs and his knowledge. So this is something that the Rambam establishes as a prohibition, as an important mitzvah. The Yireim, Rabbi Eliezer Metz, medieval Rishon, says that this was particularly limited to imitating the seven nations, but yet there seems to be an idea, and Meiri says that this is that the particular prohibition is dressing in a way that's specifically related to Avodah Zarah, and yet there's been something that's resonated that we're not supposed to imitate and be like those around us, but we're supposed to be true to ourselves. We're supposed to dress in a way that's befitting of Jewish identity. So one of the foundational sources in discussing this as particular that it comes to dress, and by the way, why is dress so important? We often get first impressions from dress. The first thing you see about a person, maybe besides how their face looks, is the way that they're dressed, the way they present themselves. That's the visual. So already in that moment, you're communicating something about itself. And even as I do believe in sharing messages about not judging people, don't judge a book by its cover, and we should see past the clothes, we should peer into people's neshamas. At the same time, we can't change the fact that the way we present ourselves does say something, that however we choose to dress one way or another makes or has the potential to make some sort of statement. So this is crucial. And one of the foundational sources involved here is the tshuva of the Maharik, of Yosef Cologne, who lived in Italy in the 15th century. And I think context is definitely helpful to know who is writing when. So he was asked a very interesting question. Can doctors dress in doctor clothing? There's something called a kappa, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, that was identified with doctors. Would it be permissible to dress that way? Why not? Because not a particularly Jewish way of dressing. Maybe it looks too similar to the way non-Jews dress. And he says that in order for something to be chukos hagoyim, to go against the prohibition of being like other nations, so first of all, it has to be that whatever you're doing, that there's no apparent reason for it. That doesn't make sense, and you're just doing it to be like them. So if there's a particular purpose, if it's obvious why you're doing that particular thing, why you're dressing that way, so then that works. And the second thing he says is that if there's some sort of pretense, if there's some sort of breach in modesty involved, and it has to do with what's going on in outside cultures, so that also would be problematic. So with these criteria in mind, when it comes to the doctor uniform, so obviously there's a real purpose to it. You're not just dressing like it just to dress like it, but you're doing that to identify yourself as a doctor, so that if somebody is injured, if somebody's ill, they know to come to you, that they know that you're the doctor. So you can see that there's a real benefit to it. So the Maharik says that in this particular case, there's no violation of Chukas Hagoyim. The Maharam Shik limits this a little bit, the idea that even if there's a particular purpose addressing in a particular way, but specifically, he says that if there's something unbefitting about the way one dresses or about a particular actions, even if it's not apparent that you're doing it just to be like them, but that in itself is entirely disqualifying it. But both the Maharam Shik lived in Hungary in the 19th century, and the Maharik agreed that there's a limit to what's chukos hagoyim, that that it has to be that there's a has to be that there's a particular express purpose to be like them, that there's something non-befitting about acting that way, dressing that way, or that it serves no purpose. The Vilna Gaon entirely disagrees with this approach. He says that if something is particularly identifiable as a non-Jewish way of dressing, so that is forbidden. He says, Divrei Hamarik in on your inklau. I don't agree with it at all. That's what he says. But Moshe Feinstein asks a very interesting question about wearing generic clothing. Can people come to America? Can they dress in a way that your average American American person dresses? Now, interestingly, we might note that I believe that there are at least certain parts of the Hasidic world where you know, not only is there obviously the very identifiable things like the shtremels and the kapatas and the like, but even the buttons are on the other side of the shirt just to be a little bit different. But that's not necessarily true. If you dress, you know, in a regular, you know, a white shirt, suit and whatever. So there's nothing, if you take a yarmulke off, you're wearing, you know, a dark suit and white shirts, you might just look like a professional. So what's there to say about this? So Moshe Feinstein says that, who says that if a Jew wears clothing, non-Jews happen to make that, they were specifically made for non-Jews. Maybe it was made for both, for nobody in particular in mind, or maybe for both Jews and non-Jews. But there's no particular reason to think that that they're made for non-Jews specifically. So for the Gra, if it's not a specific way of dressing that's specific for non-Jews, then that's not a problem. I think about my days when I was in yeshiva, before yeshiva. If you look in the white base medrash, so people, you know, dress nicely. They don't necessarily dress Jewishly. They buy, you know, their checkered shirts and you know, dark slacks, even dark khakis from the same stores that everybody else shops at. So it is very hard to define, you know, what's particularly Jewish or not Jewish in that capacity. And I would add that even, you know, the yeshivish dress that you see today, you know, black and white, in some ways, I don't know, have an actual source for this, but my sense is that that's reflective of the way Polish nobility dressed. That's the way people dressed in Eastern Europe. Certainly the concept of hats, so while today has sort of remained to be a particularly orthodox way of dressing, but it's not always like that. So I think that's an important understanding in terms of, you know, what it means to, you know, if you happen to dress the same way that somebody else is not Jewish, do you have to specifically do everything differently, or is it more just that you're not supposed to do things in a fashion that makes it clear they're trying to imitate non-Jews? When it comes to dress, in the generic sense, it seems like that you don't have to be specifically different, but just not trying to imitate that. Interesting thing comes up also with wedding rings. So I remember a rabbi that I know when he was in yeshiva. So there was a particular sichas mussar given that wearing wedding rings is chukas agoyim. That a man who wears a wedding ring is acting in a way that's not Jewish. And the truth is, I didn't even know this until shortly before I got married, because I felt like a lot of people that I knew around me did wear wedding rings. I guess I didn't pay attention that there's specific people who don't. But there are actually a lot of Orthodox Jews who do not wear wedding rings. This particular rabbi wanted to claim that it was chukas agoyim. So the rabbi I was speaking to with told me that before he got married, he went to Rav Aaron Lichtenstein and asked him, can I wear a wedding ring? I was told it might be chukas agoyim. Rav Lichtenstein apparently made some sort of a face. So that's, I think, the thing that's relevant here also, based on this Rav Moshe, based on the Maharik, that there's a clear purpose to wearing a wedding ring, that it demonstrates it demonstrates a signifier that somebody's married. We don't do it just specifically to be like non-Jews, but it's just sort of something that's become sort of a norm. So I think that's relevant there. Rav Baruch Simon brings up the question, what about graduation gowns? Because that's not a particular, you know, that seems to be a minhag of non-Jewish universities of sort, frame it that way. And it's interesting because if you go to the Chag HaSmicha of YU, which I was supposed to have last year, but was canceled due to COVID, go to the Chag HaSmicha, so nobody is wearing graduation gowns, wearing suits. On the other hand, if you go to graduation for any other of the YU schools, for Yeshiva College, for Stern, for the graduate schools, they're wearing gowns. So is that a problem with Chukas HaGoyim? So Aaron Soloveitchik apparently felt that when you're wearing a graduation gown, so it signifies that you're the graduate. So that's not a particular problem. But the Gra could argue that it's a particularly cultural thing. It's a signifier of a non-Jewish minhag, so maybe that would be problematic. But Rav Simon brings the Minchas Chinuch, who notes that dress changes. So maybe, you know, for the first people who would be dressing that way, it'd be more of a shiloh. But once it becomes sort of a norm that it's not particularly non-Jewish custom, but Jews, non-Jews, everybody does it that way, once it becomes an adopted norm, maybe it's not a problem. So with gowns, maybe it's at the very least neutral for now. And the last issue to bring up is the issue of wearing kippah versus being bareheaded. So truth is, considering how foundational wearing a kippah is, it's not, the Gemara, it's really seen as something that particular Talmid Chachamim, people did as a Midas Chasidus, it's a good way to serve Hashem, but there's no halacha that seems to require it. Even the Gemara says it's mussar to wear kippah, but not halacha. Now, then the Taz, the Tzuri Zahav commentator on Shulchan Aruch says that a Jewish male should not sit bareheaded at any time, since the custom was that non-Jews would be wearing their hats, and then they would take off their hats as they sit down. You know, you wear it outside, and then you come down, you sit, you're having a shmooze, so you take it off. So perhaps that's a chukas agoyim to not be wearing a head covering. Rav Moshe Feinstein limits this and says that nowadays, you know, regular situation, so it's not particularly Christian or religious custom to take your hat off if you're having a regular conversation. But perhaps when it comes to tula, since, you know, you wouldn't go to a church wearing a head covering, so maybe dafka with tula becomes an iser d'oraita not to wear a kippah. It goes as far back as to say that you would have to repeat your Shmona Esrei if you weren't wearing a kippah while you're davening. But I think this idea of wearing a kippah and tzitzis for men is something that is very important, because we were discussing how, and on the one hand, we're not supposed to imitate the nations, but on the other hand, you know, if our regular clothing is just sort of regular, it's generic, it's not necessarily Jewish or non-Jewish, so what makes us, if we want to demonstrate our identity, what is that? And I think that, and that's at the end of the day, kippah tzitzis are particularly Jewish ways of dress. Pinin Halacha writes that somebody who wants to go to a mixed university should dafka wear a big kippah, wear their tzitzis out to demonstrate their commitment to Torah mitzvahs. So all the more so in America and in the workplace, that was obviously a complicated question for a long time. If one wanted to be identified as a Jew and what the ramifications for that are, but nowadays that's not really a concern. And in fact, people are so embracing of diversity, and we're supposed to have diversity in the workplace and universities, that I think it's important to be able to use as a signifier of this is who I am. And yes, I'm partially part of what's going on, but I'm unique. I'm unique. I identify as a Jew, and I think that's very essential for keeping Jewish identity. If Bnei Israel were, in fact, redeemed for their keeping to their identity, so certainly it makes sense that dress, identifying that way can be part of it. And if we keep that as a physical signifier, that can help us remain committed. So going back to Dr. Halpern's article, which I was attempting to quote before, so the issues here are not necessarily about denigrating Gentiles and their customs, but it's much more about the importance of keeping our own identity. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks talked about the dignity of difference, that dignity of difference is not that, we just all sort of, say that we're all part of a melting pot and we all just kind of do the same thing. But specifically, the importance today is being able to say, yeah, you know, we have difference. And despite that, we can still treat each other with respect, and we can still maintain cordial relationships. So why is it that these things that God has redeemed from Egypt? Because there'd be no nation to redeem without this. And I think that's certainly part and parcel of Jewish identity today, that preserving our language, preserving the way we dress, the things that make us unique, not just the things that we do in home and private or whatever, but things that are really part and parcel of who we are, the things that give us our self-image. So those things are specifically important to preserve. And if we pass those things on from generation to generation, so we hopefully can instill pride in who we are. And even as we participate in surrounding cultures, we can still have those specific things that mark us as being who we are.